Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I guess we're back to doing some RMPA retrospectives. And we talked a bit about kind of, I guess, our grievances about the academic system and about other things. And so I want to move to maybe talk about some positive stuff. And these last two, I think, really, retrospects that we're going to do, I think, really play into the sort of positive nature of what we're, what we talk about and what we talk to these great interviewees. Is this the right word?
Yeah,
Interviewees about. Yeah. So,
because we're the interviewers.
we're right. And so they would be the interviewees. You'd think after doing this for so long, I'd know that by now. That's why I'm in academia. I'm highly specialized.
Don't have to know things. I have a PhD.
Well, I mean, the upside to this, and a good transition, is that we didn't know a lot about this stuff. Or maybe we knew a little bit, but didn't really know kind of the full extent of these sort of fascinating bouts of research or bits of research. On therapeutic practice and expanding kind of our knowledge and understanding of what it means to go through therapeutic practice and ways to engage with the therapeutic process and the efficacy involved. And so if you haven't, for any of our listeners haven't already, please go and listen to the our 12 Steps Too Much. It was our interview with Jason Pettit and our interview with Stephanie Johnson and Dr. Rachel Lamb. On inked therapy and their work on tattoo as therapy or as kind of a cathartic process. So fascinating. I think both of these like hit my marks for like the highest of the high that we got in terms of really good interviews. They were all great. But these were like really up there because I'm always fascinated to delve into therapy stuff that I'm not as familiar with.
I really enjoyed these, but I think there is a maybe misplacement in the use of therapy with both of these in kind of a way. 'Cause like therapy denotes like a particular like clinical relationship and a specific like methodology of like excavating like the self and then analyzing it and then like making proactive decisions about how to manipulate that and then make decisions in the future. And I felt like with both of these, they pointed more towards a lack of cultural, social dynamics that would lead someone to therapy if they had not had those experiences, right? So like the 12-step program was less about like the 12-step program's issue with that research was not that was that the 12 steps were too many, that it was too Christian, that it required a lot of like confessional. And really what helps people who are dealing with alcoholism is to have a social group that you go do things with out in nature, or you play sport, or you go on like a hike, etc. And then, kind of similarly with the tattoos, I felt that it was less like a therapy and more of a this is an event that you do to like center the self and like have an embodied experience that you wouldn't have otherwise had that then promotes psychological well-being, right? So I don't know. Like in hindsight, if I would necessarily consider these therapies or put them in that camp, just because there's not that like very specific like 20th century dialectic between like a clinical person and an individual with like an acute psychological problem.
I think that's maybe a better, I mean, from I guess if I'm gonna play, I don't know, not really devil's advocate, but I guess counterpoint. I would definitely, I think, agree with the 12 steps. I think the concept of the 12-step program is outdated and rooted in such potentially ineffective. I know it is effective for a lot of people. But I mean, that effectiveness is like 50-50. It's like chance and other things. So I think where Jason Pettit kind of goes to in that is this discussion of like looking elsewhere. So using environmental therapy, using more sound group activities as therapy, as a way to kind of overcome the 12 steps, as like drug rehab. Mm-hmm. So this kind of look at like, hey, here's what works, here's what doesn't. So even though like 12 steps isn't really viable modern therapy, there are these things that can work in its place and be just as, if not more effective in its place. The ink therapy kind of like, you know, in tattooing as kind of a kind of therapeutic practice. I mean, it does have very big like free association vibes. You know, I'm thinking of that, but I'm also thinking like if it were implemented. So like, I mean, we'll probably talk about this a bit in our like next steps, but like if it were implemented, you could develop. I think she showed in her research that you could kind of develop a methodology, a kind of a way in which to utilize tattooing as therapy. It would be a much more permanent, it was making me think of like the same as someone like going into like a carefully controlled psilocybin session. So you have a therapist with you, you're taking psilocybin. It's like, it's structured, but it's really about like making you get through this process, or, you know, using the time in that process to vent. Still very free association-y. But there's this added component, though, like with tattooing, it would be very permanent. Whereas the psilocybin could.
Yeah. I mean, mentally, it's probably very permanent.
The research seems to point that way, right? It has long-term lasting effects, so maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm thinking of like these threads of like having an outlet for catharsis integrated in your life, like having a group of people that you belong to, being able to go out into nature, having like spiritual journeys with like psilocybin, for example. Like if those were normal parts of your everyday life, I'm wondering if therapy is necessary.
Well, but maybe that's the thing. Like we're talking about drug addiction, which is highly stigmatized. Tattooing can be highly stigmatized depending on your group. But yeah, maybe regardless, if we said, well, what if we were promoting these two things? Consistent positive group activity, so social interaction with others, and a cathartic effect to allow you to release emotions, which it sounds like you get from therapy. Or from getting a tattoo, or from, you know, sitting around a circle, you know, experiencing some sort of ayahuasca shamanistic practice. We're kind of getting back to our roots. I mean, maybe, you know, we can go back to our talks on like early religious practice and say like both of these.
Right. No, that's kind of. Yeah, no, that's what both of these remind me of, is that idea that we talked about last summer, where like ritual is dead in contemporary society, and both of these projects are like pieces of ritualistic behavior that people go seek out to resolve psychological maladies.
I mean, even just going back to like the idea of like 12 steps not working, like I think, again, the continued popularity of the 12-step program might just be the ritual behind it. I mean, the fact that it is so highly tied to that ritual, and definitely with that kind of like rite of passage, the idea of the tattoo as a rite of passage or as a defining moment for an individual, as a way to kind of, I guess, recapture, because there is in part a ritual process, and there's a lot of thought for some people, a lot of thought into getting a tattoo. Mm-hmm. You find the right artist, you find exactly what you want. It has to have some meaning, or typically has some meaning for you. And so there's this added component. And then there is that repertoire between artist and person getting a tattoo. I don't know what the appropriate term, yeah, that there definitely seems to be something there. And maybe even like, maybe we would see that in the environmental. We'll have to ask our colleague when he gets off sabbatical if he finds that being in tune with nature as a therapeutic practice adds to that ritual component. Or maybe there's something mm-hmm. ritualistic about it that I don't know.
What I found really interesting, so our colleague who does the environmental research, his graduate student is kind of like falling under that same research umbrella, looking at people with schizophrenia and comparing outdoor versus indoor therapy sessions with green spaces versus like offices. And in their thesis proposal, they cited this really cool research that found it was a, what was it? Like a geographic analysis of China, and they coded green versus urban spaces in it, and then they overlaid on top of that schizophrenia diagnoses and found that people in urban spaces were much, much more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than those in green spaces.
I mean, I wonder if that too has to do, and I know we're still grappling with the long-term effects of like lead in gasoline and exposure to other things within a more urban environment. But I think you could also couple that with a lot of the research that just shows that being in those green spaces, that kind of stress reduction. So if we're looking at that, what is it called? Mm-hmm. The diathesis stress model, where it's a combination of both the kind of genetic aspects and the environmental aspects. So even if you have like a genetic predisposure, that stress might trigger it. And if you're in a more stressful environment, mm-hmm. that it can lead to that, or potentially increase one's risk for that.
Right. There's also maybe a bias in like diagnoses too. Like if you're in a rural area and you start developing schizophrenia symptoms, but like you don't like live in an apartment complex and like work with like 200 other people in an office who aren't going to notice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're out on the farm by yourself, or you know, only interacting with a couple of people, I mean, I think that there's so many cases like that of things that we understand now, where you look back on and like I could probably get stories from my parents who were like, oh yeah, we had a kid in high school like this, or I knew a guy like this and it was just a little off and we just let him do his own thing. And but now we would look at that and go, oh yeah, no, that's schizophrenia, or that's autism spectrum disorder, or that's attention deficit disorder, or like that's this thing. And there's probably also a big difference between, like, I don't know what the demographic shift is in like China. I know that when we compare like US versus places that we would see as less like quote unquote developed, these sort of first world, third world splits, the way they're kind of stereotyped, we tend to see better outcomes in places where mm-hmm. the community kind of comes together. And they don't come together in the first world country. They don't come together in the US. Right. And so we see these differences in right. how they like engage with that. And I'd wonder too, because like tattooing for us, and like, because I think these both represent two things. I think the 12-step program isn't stigmatized. I think it's just so well ingrained. But like mm-hmm. addiction is stigmatized. But on the other hand, like tattooing varies so wildly between stigmatized and unstigmatized, depending on your community, or culture or background, that it's kind of, yeah, I don't, I don't know where my thought was going with that, but like where that stigmatization comes into play, or how we might see like would we see in a place where tattooing isn't as, I guess, culturally utilized in some sort of ritual or some sort of practice, would we see like more tattooing in like different communities, like or I guess the reasons behind tattooing or why people get tattoos different based on something like that rural urban divide.
And also, like, tattooing is not a solitary practice typically in the United States, and so you usually go with like your friends. You're probably going to be in the studio for like 6 hours,
maybe more, and for multiple sessions.
Right. And so you're like visiting with like the artist, the people that came with you, the other person there getting a tattoo. Like, people take breaks during the day. Like, the pain's too much, I'm going to go sit in the lobby and like drink my Diet Coke. And you're visiting with other people who are taking breaks from getting inked. And so, like, that's also a like shared communal space, not just a I'm gonna go get a tattoo and then you show up by yourself and then you do the thing by yourself and you don't talk to anybody and you leave. Like, I think there's a social obligation to engage with everybody in the studio with you.
Yeah, I know like the reasons are different, but I'd wonder if you'd see some of similar things within like similar places in which there's that, again, that kind of communal aspect. So maybe that's part of the difference between something like an effective 12-step program or 12-step group. I mean, maybe just the difference between an effective group therapy versus an ineffective one. But it makes me think of like, could you compare it to maybe someone going once every couple of weeks to the barbershop? Like a local barbershop where everyone talks and everyone gets along and your barber, because those can really depend. Like, I've been in barber's chairs where like everyone's quiet, cut my hair, they let me go. And others who are very talkative, and to see if there's like maybe a difference or I mean, I think there's obviously a difference because there's like a pain aspect to tattooing. And that can add as this sort of additional catharsis or this additional kind of, I guess, emotional aspect to it that you wouldn't get with like a haircut. But you could still maybe get some of that social interaction. It's also longer. You're not sitting for 4 hours to get a haircut. I don't know. I've never sat for 4 hours to get a haircut.
I think you would see that with like women's haircuts and salons, though, when they go in and get their hair dyed and like bleached or permed and stuff like that, and all the women are in there together, like having that like moment. So like maybe not in the masculine like haircutting spaces, but definitely in the feminine haircutting spaces. And they like talk about their problems and their relationships and their kids and their grandkids and their shitty boss, like, and so like having those outlets of like social interaction, unstructured social interaction with like positive regard, I think is crucial for both of these. And so that's why I wonder if it's like, are these like, obviously like tattooing and like nature hikes for alcoholics are not like replacements for counseling or therapy, but they're supplemental. But I'm wondering if they're supplemental because the people in those situations don't get that anywhere else. Like, we've talked a lot about like atomization and like,
yeah,
like, you know, late stage capitalism. And so like, if you don't have like a group that you go out and go hiking with, or you don't have a space where you can go and be social with strangers in like a friendly, positive way, then like obviously your mental health outcomes are going to be pretty poor.
Yeah. I mean, it almost makes me think of like, it's like a chicken or the egg. So what came first? Like, you know, these practices stick around not only for their kind of ritualistic reason, but there's a beneficial side to like the modern transition into like commercial tattooing. And so, like, tattooing as earliest to therapy, much in the same way as we can look at, like, the shaman and a lot of these sort of practices that would eventually become in some form or adapt some form into kind of modern medicine, modern therapy. So having someone you can go and tell your problems to, this kind of in an unstigmatized way, or how like the tribe treats mental illness or treats problems within a society, and how that has kind of evolved. Whereas again, before you have a shaman, you have a medicine man or woman, and now we have the therapist, but therapists are hard to find. Or hard to get into, or there are difficulties, or can be difficulties. So we look for other ways, and maybe we're reverting back to, because these things have existed for so long, so you can't, or if you're going to spend, let's say, $400 on a therapist, instead you can go spend $400 on a tattoo, get the same effect, feel good about it, have this thing that like reminds you, hey, like, this is meaningful to me. It makes me feel good when I see it. It reminds me of these positive things. It's kind of like a prompt or a trigger for those positive thoughts.
And also, if we look at like controlled psilocybin environments, tattooing, and the alcoholic nature hikes, like these are all very sober, well, relatively sober for psilocybin.
Yeah.
But these are like non-drug induced social environments in a way,
yeah.
Right? So like if we take mushrooms off the table, like if we pretend it's not a substance for a minute, like you don't obviously are not drinking on the Alcoholics Anonymous hiking trip.
Right.
You shouldn't drink the day before or during your tattoo because your blood won't clot and then you'll end up just bleeding all over the chair.
Well, and typically like there are like social rules for that, so like the tattoo artist isn't going to let you get a tattoo if you're drunk, or at least a good one isn't going to let you get a tattoo if you're drunk. There are rules and there are,
it's like,
standards, right?
Really unhygienic. Like you also, pro tip, don't get a piercing if you drank the night before,
yeah,
because you will just bleed out everywhere. but in the psilocybin too, like you want to go in sober because you don't want to compound whatever the mushrooms are going to do to you. And so like these are all like psilocybin, we'll say it's not a substance right now, these are non-alcoholic, so like these social interactions are not facilitated by alcohol in the same way that like a bar or like a family reunion would be.
I mean, I would say you probably shouldn't go in if you've had a lot to drink the night before to a therapeutic session, right? Because you're, if you're hungover, that's going to distract from your ability to benefit from that therapy. If you're having issues with memory, drug-induced memory issues, it's not really going to help what you're learning from therapy stick. And so a lot of these same practices are still used. The main difference is like it comes down to like the actual training of the person doing it. So much like I would say much like a bartender, a tattoo artist is getting people coming in, they're having this work done, they're spilling their problems or they're chatting. And sometimes they, chat a lot. Sometimes they dump, they unload their issues for a variety of reasons. But ultimately, I mean, we're seeing like these boosts to emotional well-being and these sort of positive results because of it.
So I think that's why I would not, I think these are things in our culture and society that should be promoted outside of therapy, because I don't necessarily consider them therapeutic because they're not happening within that trained context. But I think that people should have access to be able to do these anyway to reduce normal human suffering. That would lead one to going to a therapist in the first place.
So I guess therapeutic in a sense is that they promote well-being or potentially promote well-being. They reduce some stress, but not like therapeutic in a sense of like modern therapy.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like you go do yoga and do some mindfulness practices. I would not call that therapy. But you should do that.
Right. It can be therapeutic, but it is not therapy. Maybe that's the... Yeah. I'll have to make sure I kind of key our title for that. This is therapeutic practice, not therapy. That there is a benefit. There is something there. I mean, much in the same way as just like venting to a friend can be therapeutic, can be helpful. Mm-hmm. It's not really a replacement because your friend is typically not a therapist. And if they are, they right. shouldn't. They shouldn't.
And
be
if they are a therapist, they shouldn't be.
right. Much in the same way as that. Like, if I wanted a tattoo, like even if I had a friend who was a tattoo artist, I would probably not want them to be.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I would. I mean, depending on how they were. I mean, it is a little different. Like, it is a different sphere. But like, if they messed up, maybe it would like completely change that relationship, right? I could just blame some other tattoo artist.
Right.
So. Yeah. No. Fascinating.
So where would Oh.
Go ahead.
I think we're off.
Yeah, I think
a little bit. Okay. Are we resynced?
Yeah, maybe. Go for it.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, I was going to ask you, RMPA 2024, what's the challenge? What's the new? Where are we going with this?
Maybe some more efficacy on like that 12-step replacement. So other mm-hmm. variations, other options. What's the cutting edge on drug therapy? Or addiction therapy, not drug therapy, addiction therapy. That would be, I guess, my interest in that regard. I've had some students in the past really interested in addiction treatment. We have some current students interested in some addiction treatment. What is that next step? And that doesn't involve the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested to see where the tattooing kind of as a therapeutic practice goes. I'd like to see if there is a way to kind of integrate that or to see it integrated, how people use it. How do we take what we can learn from that and bring it into the clinical setting? So whether it be mm-hmm. like building that therapeutic alliance, which I think you do get to some extent between an artist and their client. So there's this bond that's built that going through that process. And kind of the reverse, like, is there something that maybe we can pass on to tattoo artists to help them?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that thing is just like, ooh, hey, this person is venting way outside my comfort zone. Like, maybe it's just knowing to recognize and offer resources versus that person mm-hmm. who's just like, let me tell you about my day. It was a rough one. And it's just, they just want to talk.
Right.
What about you?
I would like to see the inverse. I think I would like to see the inverse. I would like to look at like quote unquote healthy people who maybe aren't addicts and start looking at what those protective factors are and using the ritual framework to see, like, are these people regularly going out and being social? Like, are they doing X, Y, and Z? Do they have a shared metaphysical belief with others? Like, do they have outlets for catharsis? Do they have positive interactions with strangers? Like, stuff like that, and see if that's like a protective factor as compared to people who maybe do fall into that addict category. And then, like, how do you reintegrate those social cultural variables to, like, you know, work yeah. around a therapeutic process to, like, get them back on their feet?
Yeah.
So study the normies.
I got a book literally just in the mail on tabletop role playing as therapy. It's been researched pretty heavily, but I think it kind of like checks. I mean, there's not like a ritual aspect to it, but it does check all the marks of like social engagement, consistent, like planned, structured meetings where you're meeting together with, it's cathartic. It's maybe not ritualistic, but there are things that you do as part of the game. So there is some like,
well, let me put this to you, like agreeing to the parameters around an imagined world with particular like metaphysical properties that everyone has to like, you know, consent and agree to with each other. And then throughout the game, they're reaffirming that imagined world is,
yeah.
Would that not be, make it ritualistic then?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of what Matt Rosano's argument against that would be.
It's like, I could see that this isn't like a sincerely held belief, and that like you don't literally believe that your D&D campaign exists in a metaphysical realm, but you still have to like engage in the like suspension of disbelief. Imagine and like put yourself like psychically into that space anyway.
Yeah, and the people I think who benefit the most from it are the ones who are like, just like we would argue, like the people who benefit most from ritual or benefit most from meditation or benefit most from anything like this would be the most open to like those ideas. And so yeah, no, I mean, I would argue that there is ritual. I mean, there is ritual involved. There is a process. There is a kind of set of rules. You're going through this thing. You get into your character. You're able to explore other variations of yourself, or aspects that are completely devoid of the self. You can completely remove yourself from your character and explore this wholly other self, which can become very, I don't want to say like disassociative, but very meaningful in helping you kind of like explore different things. And I think there's a lot of, we're seeing a much bigger growing body in like the last 10 years and in the research that's starting to heavily delve into like, hey, here's an actual study. We're not just kind of speculating on what this does. We're not just trying to tie it together. This is an actual study that shows we did this like year-long therapeutic session series, group therapy through D&D, through some tabletop game. So it doesn't have to be. It could be. There's so many others too, which would allow you to play into this. I need to just find a grad student who's interested in it. I need to find a clinical student. He wants to study because I'm really interested in that aspect, but I think it kind of fits like a D&D game is not therapy.
Right.
But it can be therapeutic.
Right.
So much in the same way as that tattoo, like that session, that 4, 5, 6 hour session multiple times a month is where you're kind of engaged in this shared imaginative experience with other people. Something there.
Yeah. People grasping for much needed ritual.
Yeah. And you can engage in ritual in the game. So I guess maybe it's the only way we get ritual. It's by proxy.
Well, I mean, I would even say the game itself is a ritual you have the DM who is like the archbishop of the game, right? Yeah. He communicates between the metaphysical realm of the game to the players, and then the players have to follow a certain series of steps in order to enact change in that metaphysical realm. So
I got a lot on my mind now, so but on that note I think we should probably call it.
Yeah,
goodbye everyone.
Goodbye.